And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. Today my guests are Diane Leslie and A.J. Albany. First up is Diane Leslie. Diane was on the show a couple of years ago with her first book, Fleur-de-Lis's Life of Crime, which spent 21 weeks on the LA Times bestseller list and 6 on the paperback bestseller list. It was also selected as one of the best books of 1999 by Library Journal and the LA Times. For nearly 15 years, Diane has been a bookseller at Dutton's Brentwood Bookstore in West LA, where she hosts author readings, discussions, and several book clubs. Her sequel, Fleur-de-Lis in Exile, was published in April by Simon & Schuster. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to talk to you again.
Well, you're my favorite interviewer, so I'm
you are
delighted
the sweetest.
To be back.
You are the sweetest. For those listeners who may not know about Fleur-de-Lis's Life of Crime, and how I can't imagine that, but for those who don't, will you talk a little bit about how that book began as a short story?
Yes. I had been looking for a way of writing about my parents, and I tried different ways, and finally I decided that since I had 61 different nannies in my childhood, that maybe I could write about my parents indirectly and write about the people who actually raised me. So I started writing a short story, first actually about our gardener, and then I wrote one about a kind of favorite nanny, a real character.
Interesting. And then you won a prize.
Yes, that was pretty wonderful. I won the Catherine M. Porter Prize for Fiction for the very long short story. And that gave me, I guess, the confidence I'd never had before as a writer. So I had written, now by the time I won that prize, I'd written 3 short stories with different nannies and people in our household. And then that helped me decide to just make it into a novel.
Had you been writing all that time? Had you been writing for years?
I've been writing since my 20s. And I'm not going to tell you how old I am now, but I'm old enough not to want to tell.
So had you
been
sending...
writing all that time. I wrote 4 novels that didn't get published. That were not about myself in the least. At least I don't think they were. And I thought I would write one last novel finally, or that might be cathartic. If it didn't get published, at least I'd have that.
That's encouraging, though. I think it's encouraging that you stuck with it and you wrote novels to learn how to write a novel, if nothing else, and then you wrote the best one, don't you think? Don't you think it's better the way you did it than, say, you had published one of them and got really bad reviews?
Yeah.
And
oh, I think I was lucky. Not one of them I like, but it's so offbeat that I don't think it would find a lot of readers. And but the rest, I certainly improved. I learned a lot writing them, and I think they were, you know, mildly publishable, but I think I'm much better off having the first novel that usually gets the most attention as, you know, something that I think is very well written.
Yes. Well, as I said at the beginning, it was on the bestseller list for such a long time, which is really kind of remarkable.
Well, I was pretty surprised. I host author readings at Dutton's Bookstore in Brentwood, and so I've heard all the awful author stories, and I really expected nothing. And so all that happened to me was a wonderful surprise, and I just had so much pleasure. I also think being older and publishing for the first time makes it certainly special. I think I appreciate it. I know younger writers who have taken their success for granted, and they expect it forever after.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest today is Diane Leslie, author of Fleur-de-Lis in Exile. Will you read to us, Diane?
All right. I'm just putting my glasses on. And, okay, I'm reading just a page and a half from the first chapter, which is called, well, let me just say, this is a book that is rather autobiographical. I think the beginning is very self-explanatory.
Okay.
The chapter is called The Invalid Invalids. A Rorschach of teardrops stained the lap of my dress. Weary of my sob story, I peered out the window of the bruised station wagon in which I was riding. If there had been a town, I'd missed it. A dusty, sun-seared landscape appeared before me, wherein grimy beer cans, French fry wrappers, crumbled paper cups and straws had been impaled on the spines of innumerable suguro cacti. From the fleeting vehicle, it seemed to me, I was looking at a petrified forest of shish kebabs. My parents, Charmian and Maurice Lee, who considered cactus so hideous they wanted the entire phylum banned from Beverly Hills, were responsible for slapping me down in this alien collage. Think of yourself as a conquistador, Charmian had suggested on the way to the airport. I'm speaking metaphorically to comprend about what you'll discover at the boarding school to which you're bound. There's no better antidote for your health than Arizona, Maurice had chimed in. He had hypochondriacal tendencies, so I paid little attention to his statement. Did I ever tell you about Junior Lemley going off to war? My mother asked. She believed in neutralizing distress with the story. Many times, I grumped, because I could have repeated this one word for word. Junior, the only son of Carl Lemley, the founder of Universal Studios, was delivered to the train by limousine, Charmian said. While Junior's mother sobbed and his father quivered, the chauffeur stowed 14 Louis Vuitton trunks, not to mention the dozen wicker baskets puckering with the young man's favorite viands, into a small, albeit first-class compartment. Mr. and Mrs. Lemley I had furthermore arranged for the chauffeur, livery et al., to accompany Junior to the battlefield. They owned a studio, so why not? Would you send someone with me if I had to go to war? I asked. Women don't go to war. They stay home and rivet. But if they did, if women were soldiers, your father and I don't have the wherewithal of a mogul. You'd have to go it alone, Charmian said. And possibly, if Junior had served in the military without assistance, he would have developed a backbone. Please don't make me go, I'd appealed to my parents one last time.
Thank you. If you just tuned in, you just heard Diane Leslie read from Fleur-de-Lis in Exile. And it's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's a wonderful book. You know, I wouldn't have known this unless I, without knowing you, I wouldn't know that your voice is so you. Your writing voice is not something other. And to hear you talk, to talk with you, and to read your book is all one and the same. And I wonder if it's always been like that for you in your writing. Did you get that voice thing down from the start?
Well, no. In fact, I just had a funny experience because I was asked by Publishers Weekly to write an article for them about myself in Los Angeles, basically, and they didn't give me many guidelines. And I found it so hard to write what is my own voice. If I'm hiding behind the character of Fleur, I can do it. And just being Diane, I found it extremely difficult. I feel like an actress who, as many actors do, not like to ever just be themselves. They don't like to do public speaking, quite a few of them. And they love being another character. So as long as I can believe I'm this other person, I can write it. And, boy, this is hard to write nonfiction.
But you are Fleur, aren't you? She's so like you. I mean, she's, of course, you're writing about a teenager and all that, but the voice is absolutely the same. It's just the way you use words. That's funny that you think of it that way.
Well, I'm glad that I was able to figure out how to do it, but I actually think the voice had to change from the first novel to the second. This one, when I left Fleur in Fleur de Lis's Life of Crime, Fleur was 12 years old, and then in this novel, Fleur's 15. Now, it's all written from an adult perspective, looking back on Fleur's young life.
Yeah.
But I had to change, really, how I presented Fleur, and that took a little doing.
Interesting. Well, will you tell our listeners and the readers a little more about the book? I notice you have a bigotry theme in this book. It's a little,
yes,
you know, a little dark.
Yes, well, I think it's darker than the last. I'm hoping it's funny, but I did. Well, what happened is that, in fact, my parents were neglectful parents, and as soon as I turned into a teenager who talked back, they sent me off to the cheapest boarding school in the United States, a horrible, horrible place, and I knew, well, the first day that I was there, I had the most dreadful and very frightening experience because Tucson is a place, and was more, and this happens in 1962 and 3. It was a place people went for the climate if they had respiratory problems. And I kind of knew that, but I never thought of myself as having any kind of sickness, but I got there, the kids played this huge prank on me that scared me a lot. But even though I was very frightened, I also knew it was funny, and I also knew, so I was 15 years old, I knew I was going to write about it too.
You did?
I did. And maybe that's my defense mechanism, because I still think this about certain things. And while I was at that school, I grew up in Beverly Hills, but at the school there were a lot of people who had every kind of prejudice you can imagine. They were a very scruffy lot, and that was very upsetting to me. So I wanted to write about that because I think kids just don't know better.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Diane Leslie, author of Fleur de Lis in Exile. Well, it is very funny. The book is just wonderful, and your turns of phrase are just delightful. I'm so enjoying this, and I was rushing to finish it before I talked with you today, and I didn't quite make it, so hopefully tonight.
I won't divulge the end, okay.
don't tell the end.
Okay.
But I'm curious, because your novel is based on your life, did you worry about offending anyone? What do you do about that? You could say, well, it's fiction, yet you're drawing on, I would imagine, people in situations that could recognize themselves.
Well, of course, there's always my mother, but my mother somehow loves what I write about. Even though I see her as the villain, she is delighted. But I give her the best lines, and I say she's beautiful. So I guess I you know, pleased her in that. And she's a person who denies many things. There were two people at the private school that I have definitely written about, one of whom I sent her a copy of The Galley before the book came out, but I felt she'd be pretty pleased by it, and she was. To me, she's the real heroine of the novel, and she was during my school days, too.
Is that Millie?
That's Millie, mm-hmm. Yeah. And she is happy with what I wrote. In fact, I got a message from her. I haven't been able to call her back now the second time, but she said she's now read the book three times. So that's good. Now, the other person who was 18 when the novel happened, I've heard from her recently. I told her I've written now a couple of books, and she just does not want to know I've written these books. So she's probably never going to read this. And it's fine, because I don't think she'd be pleased by it. But I think she's kind of a self-absorbed person who wouldn't like me to be a success. And so I think I'm safe about that, too.
So that has to be Daisy Twyla.
That is. Yeah, that is.
Interesting. Well, these characters are so clear, you know, they're so delineated. And what you've also done really wonderfully is have them all sound like themselves and not like each other. You know, you know, that's the thing about dialogue, is being able to tell a character without reading the attribution, or, you know,
right,
being told who's talking. And you've so done that. It's has dialogue always come easy for you?
I have to say it really has, probably because my mother was a screenwriter, and she wrote radio before that, and she wrote television too. And the dialogue form was kind of what I saw and heard before I actually got to narrative. In fact, I used to worry that I would not be able to write narrative. I wanted to be a playwright.
I didn't know that.
I did. But I wrote one play, and then when I heard the actors read it, and I realized that you'd have to tell them what to do and be assertive, I thought, I don't think this is for me.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here with Diane Leslie, author of Fleur-de-Lis in Exile. It's a very wonderful pink book with a birthday cake on a woman's head. You see the back of a woman. So when you're in the bookstore, look for the pink book. And you have a drawing in here.
I do.
How did that happen?
Well, I sent Simon & Schuster a drawing I did that is suggesting what the jacket of the book could actually be. And I did a drawing, but they always do photo shoots, so I wasn't thinking of it. I don't think of myself as a very, you know, accomplished artist. I'm really not. In fact, this looks like a good drawing by a 15-year-old. So I sent it in, and, well, they said the drawing was too literal to be on the jacket. I don't agree, but they were really surprised me, because they put it in the book, and I am now a published artist.
I know. That is incredible. They never do things like this, do they? I mean,
no. I'm just thrilled. I love it. And I've been signing books to people on that page to call attention to it.
That's right. It's the best place. Well, along the lines of your book being autobiographical, and this is something I'm thinking of a great deal lately, of how people write, how writers write. I wonder if in this book, or in even your first book or your fiction to come, if you draw on things people in your family or friends or people have said to you, you know, those sentences that are so powerful, they kind of lodge in your memory and you just can't shake them. If anything like that ever happens, and if you maybe write it down at the time, or you just think of it and you can't forget it, and years later it inspires you in some way.
Well, I don't write things down as they happen. I dream so little, at least what I remember. I usually write down my dreams. I don't know why. I mean, I never give them to anyone else because I'm bored by other people's dreams, but I like my own. And I would say that, well, a really interesting thing happened once. I've always hated the kind of memory I have because I don't remember facts very well. I don't remember dates and stuff like that. But I seem to remember conversations from way back or from this last week. I have a very good memory for that. But it's just always seems so stupid to remember silly conversations. Well, then I heard an interview with John Cheever, and I so admired him as a writer. And he told the interviewer, you know, I have a remarkable memory. I can remember conversations I've had from my youth until now. And he said, this is very important. This is a novelist's memory.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I thought, oh, I've got a novelist memory. And things pop in my head. But I'm not really, I also want to entertain, and I want to have a real story. So I think I improve on some of the conversations that I remember.
Yeah. Interesting. It is interesting, the writer's memory or the novelist's memory. I wonder how one would know if one has a short story writer's memory.
Yeah. Well, I think if you have a short story writer's memory, you have a novelist's memory, and
sure,
vice versa. I think that's the same. The form has, they're different problems, but the memory, I mean, you want your subconscious is what it seems to be working when you're writing. At least in my case, that's what I want to happen. And then some other part of my brain is kind of guiding what pops into my head to make it into something succinct or funny or dramatic.
Yes. Well, we're going to take a very brief break and come right back with more you in a minute. So everyone out there, stay tuned. We'll be back with Diane Leslie. Don't go away. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine, and we're at KUCI.org. And I should add that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of my guest and me and no one else, not the University of California Regents. Welcome back, Diane.
Oh, boy, am I going to give some opinions.
All right, come on. We need opinions here. Talk about the bigotry theme that is in the book. How did this come about?
Pretty much as I... This was something I didn't have to change too much. This lovely character, very nice girl, Melly, was from a Brooklyn family. I have her in New Jersey just to protect her family. And she was Jewish. And another girl, Daisy, or Twyla, because she changes her name, came to the school, well, by way of Europe, and she had turned into an anti-Semite. And she ran for president of the school, which was meaningless, really, against poor Melly, and she just started this campaign of, let's not have Jews running for office at the school. And it was very shocking to me. I'd been sheltered from that because I grew up in Beverly Hills, where most of the kids in public school, anyway, were Jewish.
So how did you know, or did you know back then that you would write about this?
Well, I don't know that I thought about it. I thought a lot about what I could do to defend Melly and get her to win the election. Now, it's funny because I don't actually remember all of what happened, but I just remember it coming up, and the whole school stopped talking to Melly, and this astonished me. And also, in my own background, my parents were like a lot of Hollywood people of their generation. They were assimilated Jews. They didn't really want much to do with Judaism. But in school, my friends, some of them were going to Sunday school at the temple, and they were enjoying it, and I wanted to do that too. And then the rabbi of their temple, after I'd been there for 2 months as a guest, wouldn't allow me to continue to go to Sunday school unless my parents joined the temple, which they wouldn't do. So I felt so unprepared. I was an outsider on every score. I wasn't Jewish, and I wasn't, I wasn't anything.
And hello again. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we spent the first half hour with Barbara Ehrenreich. We're back now with Monica Wood. She's author of two novels, My Only Story and Secret Language, and a book of connected short stories called Ernie's Ark. She's also the author of Description from the Writer's Digest Elements of Fiction series and several guides to contemporary literature in the high school classroom. Her short stories have been widely published and anthologized. Her latest book is The Pocket Muse, Ideas and Inspiration for Writing, and it's published by Writer's Digest Books. Hi, Monica.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on the show. This book is just so sweet, such a delight.
Thanks.
I'll tell you, I first saw it walking through Barnes & Noble or Borders one day, and it was somebody had put it on the side of the aisle so that it was really displayed nicely.
Oh, bless your heart.
And I know, it was great. And I picked it up, and at first I thought it was one of the Unfortunate Events books.
Oh, you mean like the worst case scenario?
No, you know those kids' books? They're like this size, they're hardbacks.
Yeah,
And it looked real similar, and I picked it up and I thought, what's it doing in the writing section? And it was your book, and it was wonderful.
Oh,
will
thanks.
You talk about how it came about?
Well, I was asked to do the book by an editor I'd worked with before on Description. And it's funny because the way Description came about was, I think it was 97 or 98. The editor, his name is Jack Heffron, really great guy, and he used to be an editor at Story Magazine. And I sent so many stories to Story Magazine that they rejected, but he was one of the editors there. And then when he moved across the hall to Writer's Digest Books, where he was going to be doing this Elements of Fiction writing series, he remembered my work and called me up and said, I think you'd be a really good person to do our book on description. And we did that. We had a very nice working relationship. And then a couple of years ago, he called me back and said, you know, description's doing well. We're really happy with it. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas for another book. And I actually really didn't, but I said, well, let me think about it for about a day. And I didn't think of it in this form. It's got a lot of black and white photos, and it's kind of arty, and it's, you know, an eye-catching book. And I was thinking of something a little more in the other format, but I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, what book would I have wanted to have when I was first starting out? And also, at sort of not even mid-career, but when I first had a little bit of success and I was working on my second novel and I was really hopelessly blocked and I just kind of fear of failure and I'd gotten this far and this is probably it and I'll never write anything again, etc. And so this ended up being kind of a combination of those two things. And I think of it really as kind of an owner's manual for a writing life.
Mm-hmm.
It has a little bit of everything, kind of how to maintain the vehicle. It talks about your writing space and choosing the right critics for your work and but how to maintain your schedule so you can keep your writing life alive. And then it has, like, sort of troubleshooting sort of things. So when things go wrong, about writer's block and envy and rejection and all the things that writers have to deal with in their life. And then just kind of keeping everything in good shape. I have writing prompts and suggestions, tips on technique, inspirational quotes from other writers. It has just a lot of little things, and most of them fit on one page. So, as mm-hmm. you said, it's a small format book, but I think that gives it a little bit of punch.
Yeah, you have so many different exercises in here, too. And mm-hmm. and was that difficult coming up with, or had
it
you...
It was like falling off a log. That's the easiest thing for me. I teach writing at... I kind of have a steady gig at the... You know, I live in Maine, and I have a steady thing at the University of Southern Maine, their Department of Continuing Education,
mm-hmm.
which basically means anybody can walk in off the street and take one of my classes. And so I end up with really amazing classes. The one I just finished now, I think the youngest was 22 and the oldest was about 80. And so they have all these great stories, and they give me really good ideas, and I'm always giving them, trying out things on them. And so a lot of the stuff in the book is just things I've tried with my own students over the years that worked. So
interesting.
Yeah, that was the easy part.
What was the hard part?
I think the hard part was what I call the homilies. And they're just little kind of mini essays on things like envy or theme or... You know, I try to make it as conversational as possible, but I'm dead serious about this stuff, and I really did this book with a lot of love, and I really wanted people to feel better about their creative life, and so I wanted to strike a balance between, you know, I didn't want to be sanctimonious about it, but I didn't want to be too much of a cheerleader, and it was hard to strike the right balance in those parts of it, but
mm-hmm.
I think I did finally.
Will you read to us?
Yeah, sure.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Monica Wood, author of The Pocket Muse, Ideas and Inspiration for Writing, published by Writer's Digest Books.
Okay, let's see. I can read, you said something about the introduction. It's a little long. Maybe I could just read part of it.
Okay.
And, okay, this is how you enter into the book. It says, 15 years ago when I was 32 years old, I quit my day job. I was a high school guidance counselor, and my job was hard, requiring equal parts objectivity and compassion to solve an ever-changing onslaught of problems. It also brought me into daily contact with people, mostly teenagers, but also teachers, parents, social workers, community leaders, sometimes even the police. The job was busy, harrying, rewarding, multifaceted. I loved it, and I quit. I wanted to write. I needed to write, until eventually the tension between my profession and my vocation became such that I had to let one of them go. Most writers, as much as they might want to do the same, can't. I was lucky to be young and relatively unencumbered, and to have a spouse willing to make the financial sacrifice with me, a sacrifice that is ongoing even for seemingly successful writers. Despite the risks, the rewards seemed worth the leap, so I leapt. For 2 years, I lived what most people would consider the ideal writing life. It wasn't ideal, however, because nothing is. Although temperamentally suited to the writing trade, stubborn, disciplined, inclined toward solitude, I felt unexpectedly lonely in my new incarnation. I found myself yearning for the job I had left, the daily hum, the voices around me, the press of real life. I had everything a writer could want, support, time, and a room of my own, and ran smack into the writer's paradox. You can't write without living fully, and you can't live fully and still find time to write. You want me to go on?
Sure, go on.
Okay. Writers get past this paradox in various ways. They work as lounge singers, which I actually did once. They write in bus terminals. They hire nannies and throw lots of parties. They become the town crank. I turned to teaching, not full-time and not year-round, but enough to engage me in the lives of people outside my own domestic sphere. It also kept my social skills from eroding completely. Teaching reminds me of what I know and love about writing. It introduces me to a fascinating cross-section of the world. In one workshop alone, I met a college student, an advertising director, and an 88-year-old retired bus driver. I've gotten to know nurse practitioners, lobstermen, psychiatrists, head waiters, new mothers, dog groomers, family doctors. I believe they come to me not only to improve their skills, but to seek a writing life. And because my own writing life has taken several forms, I believe I can help them. Every writer, whether beginner or veteran, full-time or crunch time, faces the same old problems. Problems of time management, discipline, inspiration, and motivation. Not to mention frustration, despair, and the throat-closing terror of the blank page. Oh, and joy, the exploding, dopey joy of getting the words down right. That, too, visits us all. This book will, I hope, enrich the joyful days and prevent the days of headbanging from wrecking your spirit.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Monica Wood read from The Pocket Muse. Will you read your little pieces you were talking about reading, too?
Yeah, well, there's one on envy that's kind of long, but I'll read a little bit about it, a little bit of it. Let's see. Okay, well, actually, that's kind of a downer. I'll wait. That one. Let me do the one on rejection.
All right.
I think I have it here marked. Yeah. Okay. Okay, here we go. At some point in any writing life, the writer has to decide what to do about rejection. Some people save rejection slips and laugh about using them to wallpaper the bathroom. Others get two or three rejections and quit. Most aspiring writers assume that rejection is a phase of the writing life that one simply gets through, after which success comes easily and rejection comes rarely, if at all. Boy, oh boy. In truth, rejection is part of every writing life, even ones you would never suspect. When I was a beginning writer, I attended a fiction reading by the short story master André Debussy, now deceased but still a major influence on writers both young and old. He read a story that quieted the room, and then in the Q&A afterwards mentioned that the Sewanee Review had just rejected it. I sat there, astounded and grateful, almost unable to believe that a writer of this caliber got those little slips in the mail, too. It was a turning point moment in my writing life that I will never forget. I stopped saving rejection slips after that. I had deluded myself into thinking that keeping my stash made me brave and cocky, but in truth, I saved rejections to remind myself that I wasn't very good yet, that I wasn't really a writer. Why I did that, I don't fully know, but I do know that those printed slips lost their power over me after André Debussy invoked them at that reading. They're just pieces of paper. Let go.
I like that.
Thanks.
Throwing out rejection slips, that's wonderful, and it goes against the conventional wisdom you hear a lot, which is, collect enough to paper your room.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm thinking, why? It's
right.
So depressing.
Right.
I had this bulging drawer, and I remember the day I just dumped them. I just said goodbye, and I still got them after that. I mean, I still get them now, but they just have no power at all, and you stop taking them personally, and you realize it just means that your story landed on the wrong desk on the wrong day. It doesn't mean you're a terrible writer or that it's a bad story or anything. And I love telling the story about how I came to write the book description because it really came from having my stories rejected by this editor who had worked at Story Magazine but liked my work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the stories weren't right for one reason or another, but he remembered me. And so it was a really... I don't know if serendipitous is probably not even the right word. It's just from a, you just never, ever know. And if you're not out there sending your work out, then no one's going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
That is for sure. That you can know for sure. If you don't send it out, nobody's going to see it. And if you do send it out, yes, you, of course, risk rejection, which is part of the writing life and unavoidable, really. But you honestly never know who's reading it, who's going to remember, what's going to happen the next time you send it out. I think it's great. I love the anticipation of this kind of life.
So speaking of rejection, because this is something writers are constantly dealing with, how long might you send something out, or how many times until you just don't believe in it anymore, or until it gets placed, or until when?
Well, I think it depends maybe on where you are in your career.
Mm-hmm.
There are some stories I sent out a gazillion times when it was maybe my first or second story I'd ever written, and I look at it now, I think, well, that's obvious why it wasn't taken. But still, it kept me going, and I was writing other things at the same time. It's not as if I had this one thing that I was trying to get out into the world. I'm always writing, and I'm always more excited about the thing I'm about to write than the thing I just wrote, which I think is a good way to live in this life. But I can remember a story that I really believed in, and I sent it to 18 different places, and it finally found a great home.
Mm.
And I've had students do the same thing. They think, oh my God, it's like, how much longer can I do this? And I'll say, well, let me look at the story. And I think, okay, it's done. It's a good story. There is a place for this story somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep going. You just haven't found the right place yet. And it's not easy. There are so few outlets and so many, many stories being sent out that the odds are not in your favor, no matter how good you are.
Right.
So, you know, it's not an easy life in that sense. You know, you do have to live with, I think it's something like acting. You know, these poor actors go to these auditions and get rejected all the time, and then they're waiting for their big break, and they think it's happened, but it really is just this one thing, and then they're starting all over again. I think all the arts in that sense are similar.
Yeah.
There's a lot of rejection that you have to go through, and you simply have to maintain that belief that you're doing something worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's good in and of itself, and to also remind yourself. In fact, I have all these little signs around my studio, and I'm looking at one right now that I've had up here for years, and it just says, remember why you're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not for, it's the joy of creating, it really is its own reward. But you have to remind yourself of that sometimes.
It's sort of like if you are wanting to have that book on the shelf, but you don't want to write it, that may not be,
exactly.
The thing you should be doing.
Right.
Because of the possibly years that it's going to take.
Well, you know, there's two kinds of people, those who want to write and those who want to have written.
Right.
And it's just, you know, one lasts a long time in this business and the others drop by the wayside because they can't bear the rejection, which is completely understandable. And you know whether or not you've really got the stamina after a few years of rejection. Mm. If you don't quit, it means there's something else in it for you.
Yes.
And that's, you know, I just find that a really good kind of a litmus test. If you've been doing this for a while and the rejections are coming in, but you're still writing and still enjoying it and still wanting to do it, then that's your vocation.
Yes. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest is Monica Wood, author of The Pocket Muse. What about when it isn't fun? What do you do then? Because, you know, you might know that this is your vocation, this is the thing you have to do, and you're not having fun with it.
Yeah, well, that does happen a lot. I think, again, the longer you're doing this, the more you understand what those times mean. The first time it ever happened to me, I thought, oh my God, this is it. I thought this was my calling, and I'm miserable. And then, you know, a few months later, I worked through it. I finished whatever it was that was so difficult, and I was happy again. And some books are harder than others to write. My book that I just did called Ernie's Ark was the most joyful writing I've ever done. It was just, I loved writing this book. And then the one before that a novel called My Only Story took 4 years, and I was pretty much miserable the whole time, except for the last 10 months when I finally figured out who the narrator was supposed to be. but you just kind of plow through. I don't know. I've got a few things in the Pocket Muse about that. One is there are no page numbers in this book, so I can't find it just right off the bat. But
let's remember to talk about that.
It's something about when I'm feeling... not so much unhappy, but bored with my own work, that it's something I've read over so many times, or it's a novel that's a really long haul, and there's just going to be places in it that aren't as interesting to you as other places. And one of the things I do, I just literally change the scene. It's the same dynamic, the same people are in it, but I move it from a church to a street corner, or from, it's to make it, the little ancillary details become fresh to me then, and it feels as if I'm writing new stuff, even though I'm really just reworking a scene that I've already done 8 million times.
Mm-hmm.
So there, you know, little psychological games you play with yourself to make it feel fresh.
Yeah. What about the deal with no page numbers? How did that come about?
Oh, don't get me started. This was really, I don't know. The short answer is I don't know, but apparently it was a decision made right at the last minute, because even in the front you can see it has photo credits, and, and the, it was supposed to have numbers, but I think it was a art department last minute, and I think they felt they were so committed to the design, and they did a really beautiful design, that I think they feared that putting page numbers would screw up some of the pages, just the way it
visually
looked,
huh?
You know?
Yeah.
So, and I don't really mind it. I think it just makes it sort of quirky. And the only time it's annoying is times like this, when you can't say, well, what about page such
right.
and such? So, but I think it was just really a design thing.
Yeah. Well, it is really gorgeous. The photos are beautiful, and the paper quality and the printing really is one of the most beautiful writing books I think I've seen. It's just really...
I was so happy with it. They did a really beautiful job.
Now, did you have any say over the photos?
Well, some of the photos came from me. I'm not a photographer, but I got... I love this story because it's... I don't know if you, it's in the middle of the book somewhere, but it's a man with his arm around a llama.
Yes.
And it looks like he's wearing, it looks like a bus uniform or something. Mm-hmm. Well, this is my friend Ron Ellis, who was the head keeper at the Prospect Park Zoo in Brooklyn in the 40s and 50s. And he had a whole stash of photographs from that era, and I had heard about them, but I hadn't read, I hadn't seen them. So, this is a man, I'm from Mexico, Maine. It's this really small mill town in western Maine. I live in Portland now, but he's friends with my family. And so I went up there, and I was talking to him. I said, don't you have some, I was telling about this book I was doing. I said, don't you have some photographs from your zoo days? Well, he took them out and showed me these great photos, and I asked him if I could use them in my book. And you would think I had just given him the winning lottery ticket. He was so tickled, and he was 93 years old at this point. And he said, sure, I'd love to have them in your book. And so I sent them down to Cincinnati and said, what do you think of these? And everybody just loved them. And so they used several, most of the animal photos in here are from him.
Mm-hmm.
And the one of him with his arm around the llama. It's so cute. It looks like they're
beautiful.
About to kiss.
Yeah.
And he loved these animals. He has these really funny stories about the zoo, his zoo life. But the book came out last April, at the end of April, and he started ailing in March, and it was really sudden. This was the most robust, wonderful, gorgeous man, and he had a heart thing that just was a aneurysm, just basically a ticking bomb, and we sort of knew that his time was limited. And so one of the production editor called me and said, hey, I've got the advanced copy. It's right in my hands. I'm going to send it to you overnight. And I said, don't send it to me. Send it to 17 Gleason Street, Mexico, Maine, because there's somebody there who I just so wanted him to see the book before he left this world. And sure enough, it got overnighted. And the next day, they called me. His wife called me, actually, and she said, well, we got the book. We're all excited, and he was excited and loved seeing his photos. But I honestly got the feeling that he was more excited about having gotten an overnight package from a publishing company. It was so cute. And about months after that he did die.
Mm.
But he really got to fully enjoy it. And it, to me, it was a real lesson about that you're really never too young for something to happen to you for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
He was tickled to death that this was happening. And it was just, it was such a wonderful thing. It really was. And I have another friend who's kind of a amateur photographer, really, but several of his photos are in here. I sent them down, and they liked them. In fact, the one on the last page, it shows a window of a church, and underneath, etched into the stone, are just the words, "I was glad."
Mm-hmm.
I love that photograph. In fact, I wanted to call the book "I Was Glad," but they fortunately told me they weren't going to call the book "I Was Glad." But I really like ending it with that image and just the idea that, you know, I was glad that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful image.
Yeah, it is.
And you have quotes throughout here from authors and all sorts of things. And I can understand why there's no page numbers.
Yeah.
It's because you want to feel like you can just open it somewhere and you don't have to start at the beginning.
Well, that is the idea, that it's not a book you read page 1 to 250. You just pick it up anywhere and I hope you'll get something from every page.
Yeah, I think so. It's just, it's gorgeous. it really is. And we have a couple of minutes left, 2 minutes actually. And I wonder if you have any words of wisdom here for the writers listening, especially the struggling writers.
Oh, gosh. Well, obviously, don't give up. And just, I'll tell you, tell them all, I'm telling you right now, whoever's listening, you get these little index cards and you write on it, "Remember why you're doing this," and you hang it up somewhere in your space, wherever your space is, where you can see it. And the other quote I really love from my friend Ron Carlson, who I think has been on your show.
Yes, definitely. A few times.
End of a kind of complicated story he tells, but I have it on the door of my studio, so every time I leave, it says, "The writer is the one who stays in the room."
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm tempted to quit early and I've got my hand on the knob, my eye is right level with this little sign.
Yes.
And so just, you know, gosh, you just have to, you just do it.
Yeah, you just do it. You stay there. You keep you keep yourself in the seat.
You do, and you make the time. I was talking to my students. We had our last class on Monday, and they said, "Oh, it's so hard to find the time," and I said, "But if you can't find the time, then it's telling you something about whether or not you really want to do this."
It's like Ron Carlson said on a show. He said, a drug addict doesn't say, "Yeah, you know, I love taking drugs, and I'm going to get around to it someday."
Yeah, that's a great that sounds like him. That's a great analogy.
"I'm really going to do it someday. Just, you know, one of these days when I retire, you know, I'm really going to get to it."
Exactly.
Thank you so much for coming on.
You're so welcome.
You've been quite charming, and the book is great.
Oh, thanks.
And I wish you much continued luck with it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You're quite welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Monica Wood, author of The Pocket Muse, Ideas and Inspirations for Writing, and it's published by Writer's Digest Books. Very, very gorgeous little writing book. It's fits in the hand wonderfully. It feels nice. All the things that you want an inspirational writing book to be, it is. It's great. If you have any comments or questions or would like to know about future guests and events in the area, visit my website at writersonwriting.com. There you can sign up to be on the mailing list. The ASJA conference is coming the beginning of May, first weekend. Go to asja.org. It's a wonderful conference. I'll be there, and I hope to see some of you there. And I'd like to leave you with a quote by Annie Dillard, who said, "Appealing workplaces are to be avoided. One wants a room with no view, so imagination can meet memory in the dark." You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening, and please stay safe.